So thanks again for having me here in Poland. This is the third time that I've been here and the third time that I've spoken. And it's not there, so it doesn't show up.
Okay, because we don't have a projection back there, so.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm here to talk to you about Tor. And if I don't have slides, I suppose I can always. Yeah, do you have
USB
them on?
USB sticks or something?
Yeah, if you have a USB stick, we can put it on another computer. But I'm here to talk about something that I think is sort of important, which is that we can talk about the Tor protocol, and I think that's kind of an interesting topic. And I think that most of you here have probably used Tor. Can I get a show of hands of people that have used Tor? It's not bad. I was hoping for all of you, but maybe next time. let's see if that. That'll teach me to use that laptop again. So I want to talk to you guys about something that's kind of strange, which is that I've been working on Tor now for about 5.5 years, I think. Basically, I get an interesting opportunity, which is that I get the possibility to travel around the world and talk to different people who need Tor or who use Tor in some capacity in their job, or perhaps they use Tor as part of law enforcement, or they use Tor as sort of the conduit for information in the rest of their world. And so I started taking a little bit of, let's say, an active interest in some of the networks that some of these people use. And so I'm going to cover a couple of networks and sort of talk about how those networks have evolved and what we can do, and specifically what you guys can do. So I looked last night and I saw that there were 20 different Tor nodes in Poland and only 2 in Krakow. And I feel like that's something that can change. And I think it's actually gone down since the last time that I was here, which doesn't bode well, I think. I've heard that there have been some proposals at laws to remove, let's say, the ability for people to run Tor servers or anonymization services. And I've even heard that there was a person in the Polish government that was interested in banning Tor by name. That doesn't really strike me as a particularly good path for your country to take. But what do I know? But what I can show you is the path that some other people, well, that's more reliable for sure, what other people have taken in their countries. And I'm a little bit concerned about what seems to be the path for this presentation, as well as the internet in general. How are we doing?
Doing fine.
That's good, all right. So I guess, I don't know, I don't need my slides, but I had the opportunity recently to study Arabic in the Middle East for a small period of time, which is not nearly the 20 to 30 years that you really need to get it down pat. But the time that I spent there, I traveled from Lebanon to Qatar, and then to Egypt, to Jordan, and then finally I was lovingly deported from Lebanon by the hands of the Lebanese government that decided that they didn't want me there. That's kind of a story for another day. But in short, an interesting thing that I noticed among each of these countries was that all of their internet connections have extremely heavy filtering or strange monitoring. When I was in Lebanon, I found that there were 2 major ISPs that shunted all of their traffic through something that some of you are probably familiar with. One of them is a piece of software called Squid. And as we know, historically, Squid is probably one of the most wonderful free software proxies in the world, but it's also not the most secure. So running all of your traffic through it might not be such a hot idea. And of course, some of these different proxies also filter, and some of them simply log, and some of them simply add latency and probably do both of those things, but it's difficult to tell. In Qatar, what we found, and specifically what I was interested in, is that there's a telecom monopoly called Qtel, or Qatartel. Qatar Telecom or Qatar Telecom, and they have a very serious monopoly on the internet connections in Qatar, which means that they have the ability to randomly break Skype, or they have the ability to simply block different internet connections. And I mentioned this at the Chaos Communications Congress in Berlin, but the basic idea is that if you want to look at the future of the internet in the rest of the world, you can simply look to some of these places in the Middle East, because the software that's actually used in these places to produce this networking, filtering, and censorship to break actively different network protocols that are being used, you can note that the software is usually designed in North America or in Europe, and the hardware is usually fabricated in Asia with software that's programmed in Europe again. In the near future, there will be an entire country whose all of their traffic will be going through a large high-speed deep packet inspection machine, and every time that a person in that country visits YouTube, the YouTube video will be cached and forwarded to the police. I wonder, like, if this is the future that we want to have. I personally think this is not the future that I want to have on the internet that I'm a part of. And I think that this is a very scary trend, because your data trail paints a picture of you that is not necessarily the truth. And that's something that's extremely concerning to me personally. Especially, I had the, I would say, fortune, but maybe misfortune, of meeting someone who works in the Swedish government a couple of weeks ago. And they were one of the people behind the idea of key escrow. Are you all familiar with this? The idea that you should have to put your cryptographic keys in with a trusted third party, and then, you know, everyone will be safe, because so that third party can decrypt messages when they need to, and, you know, lots of buzzwords about why this is good, and lots of scariness about why this is good. But basically, because we don't have key escrow, we have the ability to do sales on the internet. I mean, it wouldn't really be, I think, a tenable thing to have any transactions where I knew that I had to trust someone other than the person I was doing business with. But this person is now on the data retention panel, and he is one of the technical experts for the European Union. And I had a very frustrating conversation with him. He means well, for sure, but the level of technical expertise is extremely low. For example, trying to explain to him that a log that contains an IP address is not good, that it should be treated as the lowest of circumstantial evidence, was extremely difficult, if for no other reason than simply because he does not understand the way that BGP works, and he does not understand the way that one can insert data into a log. So even if the log is perfect, if it's cryptographically signed when it's kept, it's still not as good as a person testifying in court. Because a person can tell you about the situation, and a person can tell you about whether or not it was somehow sketchy, or that their memory was not so great. Oh, sure, we could use the slides, too. It would be this keynote one. Fantastic. Awesome. But so it strikes me, I'm holding my breath here. Oh, maybe not. Okay. It strikes me as particularly worrisome, because the people that are making the policy decisions and the people that are deploying these deep packet inspection networks, they've never hacked a computer in their life. They've barely used them. Right? That's very scary. I hope that things are a little bit better here in Poland, and I trust that they are to some extent. Although Sweden is an extremely wired country, so it does strike me as a little bit scary that that is the case in a place like Sweden. It seems to me that the only way that these things are changed, the reason that Sweden and Europe does not uniformly have key escrow for all cryptographic operations, that's all your PGP keys, all your SSL keys, all your passphrases potentially in certain circumstances, is because that guy lost the first time. So what we need to do, especially on a European Union level, is make sure he loses a second time. And it's nothing personal against that guy. But the only way that it's possible for us to escape this sort of crazy digital police state that's being built right now at the European Union level and in North America and in Asia and South America and in Africa and the Middle East, everywhere you look, this is happening. The only way that we can resist this is if we collectively acknowledge that it's happening and we actually moved for this to not happen in places where it's possible for us to have democratic action. And Poland seems to be a place where this is possible, but it takes people that are actually Polish, that believe this, that are active in your own government to make that happen. And if you do that, I think the rewards will be fantastic, because the places that don't have this type of filtering will be able to get ahead in a very serious way. Because filters like this can be horribly abused. Because what happens when you have a filter like this is it starts with something like, oh, we're going to stop child pornography. Never mind that the police have never actually tried to turn down any of those child pornography websites. They just say, well, like, it's on the internet, it's unstoppable. Like, all these cypherpunks built these unbreakable, unblockable cryptographic protocols, and it turns out all you need is, like, a web server with PHP. At least that's about the amount of effort that you need so that the police won't take it down. And ironically, that's what's used to justify all of these filters. But what happens is, as we recently learned in Australia, is that you end up in a situation where it's kind of unbelievable. They actually even bothered to block, accidentally, on purpose, it's unclear, a dentist's website, right? So we're talking about a filter that before it was even launched nationwide, its scope had creeped to blocking a dentist. This is ridiculous. This is not what the internet is supposed to be. This type of encroachment by politicians that hardly understand the technology is the worst. I mean, it's absolutely the worst. And this presentation is almost not even on track anymore, but it strikes me as being, is this Microsoft Word? Man, I'm not sure how to use that. All right. So, but it is in Polish, so I have an advantage. Yes, there we go. I've been practicing my Polish. I would like... No. Oh, good, it doesn't work. That's okay, I can't actually click that button. That's fantastic. Fuck it, who cares? Okay. If anyone whose computer that is wants to fix that, that's fine. But, all right, fantastic. We've got slides. Yeah. Awesome, thank you. All right, yeah, so, you know, you don't care who I am. I'm already here. Mystical, come on, advance, slide, advance. Oh, this is not going well, is it? Oh, that's the worst slide to get stuck on, too. I couldn't have a better onion. That would be fantastic. Oh, man. This is great. I win at promotion of this awesome slide deck. Yeah, there's one that we could talk about. So... I sort of been over this a little bit the last two times that I was here. But the Tor network has been growing. In certain places it's been slowing, and that's a little bit concerning. We're free software, all this crap, you already know all this stuff. You don't need me to repeat it, it's not important. In the last year or so, I've had the opportunity to meet with people from a bunch of different groups. And I don't really care very much about any of these groups. Except for the blocked users and private citizens. I mean, governments have tons of money, they can hire someone else to tell them about what I'm saying. However, anonymity in the context of a censored user is particularly interesting to me. Imagine for a moment that you are in Iran or you are in Poland and you are using the internet and everything you do is being watched, it's being logged. The integrity of all of your data is in question to some extent also, because without encryption, when someone is able to target you, they are able to change that information, perhaps customizing it just for you. So that's something that is a little bit concerning, and something that Tor sort of, let's say, can help you with, but doesn't solve the entire picture. But ultimately, the reason that I'm here is that I want to talk with you about censorship, right? So usually people don't get a choice when they're censored. Like trying to learn about sexual and reproductive health information can be an extremely troubling thing, depending on where you are in the world. Most of the world is largely misogynistic and doesn't want women in any way to feel empowered about their own body. You can see this with extreme religious organizations, and you can also see it with extreme statist organizations. It's kind of strange how that works out with a little bit of extremism. But the thing that's interesting about network filtering is that it's kind of indiscriminate. Like, you can have a border guard that says, like, oh, you know, actually this is an okay topic for you to bring into the country, and this is not an okay topic. With network filtering, it just sort of catches things, and it catches a lot of things. And unlike network filtering, the people that are running these devices are, or I should say unlike border guards, the people running these devices are not necessarily going to be able to have the same kind of transparency. It's hard for, say, five people's requests to stack up and those requests to sort of look at each other in awe. Why are we being filtered today? It doesn't really work the same way as a customs line, and it's a lot less transparent. There have been generally in different countries actions by governments that are actually made up of the citizenry that actually implement the way that border entry is done. Like, for example, in my country, we've created quite a shame about it, and we fingerprint and photograph everyone. And in a sense, as an American, I'm responsible for that crap. And I know it. And it's unfortunate, and I'm very sorry about it, and I'm working to change it because I think it's the wrong thing. But that's really hard when people don't even acknowledge that the filters exist. So in China, they say they don't filter the internet. Right? This is incredible stuff, right? I mean, it's incredible if only because it's so obvious to everybody except the billion people living in China and the hundreds of millions of them on the internet that are filtered. Some of them know, and some of them don't. All right. So I think that it's probably the case that some of you have and will again make this interesting discussion point, which is that there are bad people that are doing bad things on the internet, and there are bad people that are doing bad things in general. And I want to, I'm sure that this isn't the first time, but I want to discuss an interesting point, or at least interesting to me, which is that I think that the solution to bad speech is not a reduction of speech or a reduction of the capability to speak. I mean, we all exist today without a filter, a mechanical filter around our box, like our voice box right now, totally, absolutely free. I can say anything that I want. And the interesting thing about that is that society, in a sense, keeps people able to interact with each other without that sort of like filter there. But with the internet, what people are trying to say is that it's a necessity. But this is a battle that has been fought time and time again, which is that people push for as much power as they can take, and people cede as much power as they think is reasonable. But in certain technological cases, there are, what, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 people in this town that understand this topic? It's not a lot. It's a really very strange topic for a lot of people, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. And so I think that when people are talking about censoring websites and they're talking about removing information from the internet, they're doing it wrong. They're making a mistake. If you want to catch a child pornographer, you don't stop them from publishing that information. You let them publish it, because now you have evidence that you can use in traditional police work to actually find the criminal. I mean, people talk about how there's a sort of spike in activity on the internet with, for example, child pornography. But an interesting thing about the internet is it allows people to speak, and it allows them to speak freely in a way that they haven't before. So previously, there was apparently an epidemic where there were people that were committing abuses against children. This is not too surprising. But an interesting point is that it used to be in shoeboxes, because generally child abuse happens when people are abusing someone in their own family. And so those people take those photos and put them on the internet now. And all of a sudden, society has realized that they have a big problem on their hands. But that big problem pretty much always existed. The only difference is that now we understand it as a problem. And this is kind of an unintended consequence. I'm sure Vint Cerf had no idea that this was going to happen with the internet. But the solution is not to erase this from history. It's not to stamp out the symptoms, to actually track it down and to solve this problem and to help people that are in this situation, or to arrest them depending on how far they are from help, or to help them if they're the victims, of course. And I think that this is important, because that is sort of a controversial stance, I think, because generally when you see something like that, you want to destroy it. And that's probably a good impulse, but it might result in more harm in the long run than thinking critically about the problem and not sort of submitting all of ourselves to an unending amount of filtering, which may end up with starting with something noble, like trying to put down child abuse, and ending with dentists and other political views that are silenced, which of course is the case. There are people who write websites that are critical of filters in certain countries, and they're the first to be censored. That's a really interesting thing when you think about the fact that that's a political action. Politically, someone is being censored, and someone is responding and trying to say, like, I just don't believe that this concept of censorship is okay, and they're erased from the internet as if their ideas and their views don't exist. So the people that I had the chance to meet while I was traveling through the Middle East were awesome. I got to meet with bloggers, and bloggers everywhere seem to be under threat, and it's kind of incredible in the Middle East. One of the bloggers that I was with was actually detained in Egypt when he went home. His house was raided. He lived with his mother at the time. And his house was raided, and he was arrested. He was convicted of a couple of crimes relating to his writings online and not relating to his writings online while he was gone. And so they arrested him, took his passport, put him in jail. That's very sad, but it's extremely common. And I met with some journalists, including some incredibly bright people from Al Jazeera. they have a very interesting stance on news. They have an interesting stance on being able to publish and in being able to do investigative reporting. And it's really fantastic, actually, to see that they have an interest in privacy and security. And of course, all across all of the Middle East, there are always people that are working in IT that are doing interesting things. And human rights activists are, of course, I think, the people that have a soft spot in my heart, because they generally look for things and go places that other people wouldn't, and they don't do it for money. So these are people that put their lives on the line to be able to document police brutality, that are out there to talk about things that are happening that are not necessarily something that will gain them, let's say, social stance in their communities. This is stuff that will get their families killed or their friends. These are people that you directly help if you run a Tor server, if you run a Tor bridge. These are people that need help, because we enjoy a privilege, especially in Europe, we enjoy a great privilege. And that means that if we share that privilege with some of these people, they will be able to help their station, their lot in life, just a little bit more by being able to read information that's otherwise censored, or to be able to communicate with someone and not putting themselves or their family at risk. And so I think that's important, because we can talk about all the bad uses of Tor, but I can also tell you about the good uses of Tor. And the people that are using it inspire me to do better things with my life. And I hope that, in a way, you are too inspired. So we have a big crash course in Tor, but because of the slide fuck-up in the beginning, I think it's probably better that I don't go over too much of it. Basically, anybody can run a single-hop proxy. But it creates, especially in the United States with the Patriot Act, which is essentially an unconstitutional law that allows the police to do whatever they want, whenever they want, it's just not possible to build systems that are what are called privacy by policy anymore. Privacy by policy says, I promise that I won't look at that data. Okay. I promise that I won't log that data. Oh, gosh, you know, I said I wouldn't log that data. What I meant is I won't share that data. Oh, you know, actually, I'm going to share that with some really important people in my business community. Oh, gosh, one of them was double-clicking Google. So that's not really strong, right? We want something stronger than that. And additionally, anybody in the United States or in any other single country, they live in some place. And wherever that place is, they're subject to those rules. And as long as those people are subject to those rules, they're going to end up in a situation where they can be coerced. And maybe it's legally, and maybe it's genuinely good that that can happen in certain circumstances. But maybe it's extra legally. And if it's extra legally, perhaps it's at the threat of violence. So running these services can be a very serious problem for you. But it just so happens that in some cases, you end up where it's not about violence, it's not about blocking a particular user, it's often about tracing a user. The YAP people in Germany built a system and the police forced them to put a back door in, for example. When you build systems that are single entity controlled, it's real bad news for everybody. But as it just so happens, many of these proxies are simply blocked, whether they're single hop privacy by policy proxies or they're multi-hop privacy by design proxies like Tor. So I wanted to point out this information from one of the wonderful Iranian national policemen, and he actually talked a little bit about proxies, and he said something that I thought was really interesting. And so when I'm talking about how we can all make a difference, we also have to talk about the risk we invite. So when people in Iran are using things like this, and it's not just Iran, but it's a popular example, so I'm using it for now. He says these people should know where they are sending the SMS and email, as these systems are under control. They should not think using proxies will prevent their identification. If they continue, those who organize or issue appeals about opposition protests have committed a crime worse than those who take to the streets. Can you imagine that? Isn't this like something out of, it's like Neuromancer writ large, right? I mean, this is incredible stuff. I mean, they have created a filter net, as I so eloquently outlined on the slide borrowed from this article. But the idea is that they filter everything, and they log everything, and then they go to people's houses and they arrest them. Or for example, they have a protest, they let the protest happen, and all of the people at the protest carry cell phones. And then the next day, the police go to all of those people's houses and beat them up, or arrest them and kill them, or worse. Right? So the interesting thing here is that they really want to identify people. They want to identify people because it allows them to control those people and to harm those people. And these are people that are simply talking about nonviolent organization to speak their will. in the streets, to be able to say, I want something different than this. So this is sort of, the future of any civilization, basically, where you have large power structures in control, especially centralized power structures at the top. Because you end up in a situation where someone can make a statement like this, and they can enforce these rules that they have created. And that's some scary shit. I don't want to live in that world. Do you guys want to live in that world? Come on now. Silence is complicity? Yeah, well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. So here's the thing. I feel like a pompous asshole as an American coming up here and telling you guys that there's a better way. My country is being wiretapped by the NSA. Every phone call I've ever made in my entire life, probably, but definitely in the last 10 years when I lived in San Francisco. Because you see, in San Francisco, at the intersection of 2nd and Folsom Street, we actually had AT&T and NSA wiretapping all of the traffic flowing through their building. And they got caught. So the Billboard Liberation Front in San Francisco made this handy modification, right? AT&T works in more places like NSA headquarters. It's a pun on their advertisement they have all over town. But the fact of the matter is, we're not different. You see, the United States is part of the problem, which is often the case in international issues, but is specifically in this case. And it's a little bit troubling, because we have this situation where, because there isn't active injection, there isn't someone sending a TCP reset, people aren't up in arms. They just don't even think that this is a problem, which is amazing. Some of the best hackers that you will meet from the United States might not even know that this is happening. I spoke to a crowd of people, most of them were old Bell Labs people, and these are just like the most brilliant people you've ever met in the world, and they hadn't even heard about this. And the EFF has sued and sued and sued, and they've lost a couple times, but they've won a couple of times. And each time it has been ruled that what the government has done in this case is absolutely not all right. So my country has problems too, and we're working to change them, but there's only so much that can be done so quickly. And part of the problem is that it's very difficult to defend against filters when someone says, well, Australia's doing it, it's not just China. Oh, well, Denmark does it. Oh, it's Sweden. You know, Sweden has filters also. You know, this is just national interests. They're just protecting their national interests like everyone else. And of course, Sweden is an interesting place because it actually has a real dedication to the rule of law, because they actually passed the FRA law, which allows them to do this kind of state surveillance of the entire internet. There's no other country in the world that has passed a law like that. But the Swedish people really believe in transparency and openness, so they passed that law. Many people were extremely upset about it, but they passed that law, and it's in the open that the FRA can wiretap all the connections going through Sweden. And of course they do this because Norway, Finland, and Russia pass all their traffic through Sweden, and it's of extreme intelligence value to trade that with the United States and other countries. But that's interesting because it gives you an idea about how the Swedish people feel about it, and it also gives you an idea about all the other governments and what they're doing at the same time. And maybe this is a reality that, you know, I should learn to live with and we should just get over it. But I think instead we should fight back. And I think it's important because we can. So I mentioned this idea of privacy by design. So if router one up there that Alice is talking to is in Zimbabwe, and router two is in Japan, and router three is in the United States, and it goes to a website, Alice goes to a website through all of those routers, and she hits a website in, say, Germany, it's going to be very hard to identify her. And those logs, that data retention stuff that's going to be logging all this information, in some cases, depending on where those jurisdictions are, logging and how they log, for example, one logs incoming, one only logs outgoing, that can be funny if you switch that up. I think that we can create a viable resistance for now. But this is unfortunately not good enough, right? You end up in a situation where, at the end of the day, these firewalls and these filters are socially successful. When people put their head down and they look at the ground and they don't want to fight back, that's the problem, is that when that environment exists, it's simply not possible to change these things. We have to engage and we have to actually work towards that. And I think that that's something that is easy to say, but not necessarily easy to do. But at the moment, there are plenty of people around the world who live under that type of filtering and logging regime, and they need your help, because it doesn't exist here yet in the same way that it does there. It doesn't exist with the extreme level of monitoring as in the United States here. And if I can bounce my connections through Poland, and that will help me to hide that I've read a Wikipedia article about heart disease in my family, for for example, that could be really useful because later that information builds a data trail about me. Maybe that will help with pre-existing conditions so I will never get healthcare again for the rest of my life, as an example. I mean, the insidious nature of the filtering and logging that takes place just depends on where you happen to connect to the internet or the filternet, as that article so aptly described it. So, fortunately and unfortunately, Tor uses a simple centralized design protocol. Basically, all the servers publish to a server, and those servers push out to other servers. And Alice will download a list of those servers. If we're talking about pervasive filtering, does anybody see a problem with this design? It's a pretty big one, right? Which is that all you have to do is make sure that when Alice in Myanmar or Burma, as it's also called by other people, that they're not able to reach any of those servers. And in fact, that's what China is doing to the Tor network right now, right? They don't just block our website, they actually block our protocol. And they block it by lists of servers that we give out. And we have to give them out so Alice can make smart choices about how to use the internet safely. So this is basically a given that if the internet is being filtered, that proxies are being filtered. It's very strange to travel to a country and write on a customs form that I work for Tor, because often when I use the state-sponsored telecom in that country, I find that I can't reach my own work website, which is a little strange thing, right? But because this tool can be used to circumvent the filtering, it becomes persona non grata, or I suppose whatever you would call it when software is that way. But it's pretty much a given. So almost all the places that I went in the last year that were not in Europe filtered the Tor website. And ironically, in Canada as well. I was giving a talk in Canada and they filtered the Tor website, which was fantastically strange. But the, you know, it drives home the point, which is that this isn't just a thing that's happening elsewhere, it's happening everywhere. So we figured out a way to get around this, which is that spam is really hard to block, right? So part of the reason is because still to this day, no one has effectively built really good spam filters. And it's really hard to do them at the deep packet inspection layer type of thing. I mean, it's not impossible. Some countries do this. But in our case, we decided that we would use a different overlay network to supply access to our overlay network. So you send an email to get.torproject.org, and this is how a lot of people in China have been getting it. And we send you a copy of Tor. And we send you either source code or we send you a build for your platform. And in certain circumstances, we'll even send you a pre-configured web browser and a chat client with OTR. So you get everything right off the bat. We don't care where you're from, we just give it to you. And if you want to run one of these mirrors, for example, you can download all the source code. This program is available. It's like a WARES server over email from the 80s or 90s or something. It's kind of incredible. But this is actually useful. This works, which is kind of great. Here's some graphs. These are pretty much current as of right now, but they go back to February. And at one point, we actually had about 450 people in a single day downloading Tor this way. We have ridiculous numbers of people downloading Tor directly, but this is just people that are like, well, I can't get to the website this way, and I've heard about this email thing, and I can receive an email package that is that large. So that's pretty useful. That's often people who can get to Gmail, for example, but they can't get to the Tor website, or they can't get to Gmail, but they can get to Yahoo Mail or another server that uses DKIM. So that's kind of nice. Unfortunately, as I mentioned, China is actually blocking everything, right? The whole Tor network. And basically what this means is that when Alice is trying to talk to any routers in the Tor network, they just can't. So we invented this thing we call a bridge. And this is awesome. I'm sure at least one of you wants to run a Tor bridge or a Tor server. Does that sound about right? Is there anyone here that would be interested in helping with this? Just one? That's one. Thank you. So good. I was hoping for two with that pitch, by the way. But I guess you can't ask for much. So the thing is that a bridge is awesome because it puts you at zero liability, and it also, you only need one security property that's useful at this point, and that is availability. So the idea here is that you turn on this Tor relay, and it's like every other Tor relay. You have strong crypto, and it actually helps you to be anonymous on the internet. As a user, you just use this bridge, and it's your first hop into the network. And that system just needs to be available. And the risk to you is that one day you end up in one of the Chinese filters, and then you're blocked. So you have a spare IP address, and you really have nothing to lose at all. And the way that this works is we have a bridge database, and we hand those out to people. So we have a set of pools. So we have a pool of IP addresses, that we give out via email. If you mail getBridges@TorProject, we'll send you some bridges. And we have some that get handed out over HTTP from bridges.torproject.org. And then we have a couple of other systems like Twitter, and we have people that we know that we'll pass them to that are social hubs. And we've actually found that this works relatively well. It's essentially a darknet. But the thing is that, well, it is a darknet to some extent. We took an intractable problem, which is never letting any government or any filter or any company know the list of all the Tor servers, and still making Tor usable. That's not possible. We can't do that, right? And then we said, but what we can do is we can say, here's a small subset of servers that some people can learn about, and they can learn about it some of the time. And if they learn about some of it, they can sometimes block some things. So that's really extremely useful to have that. Because what it means is that you end up in a situation where you can actually resist this, because it's about having a bit of knowledge. Because these people aren't doing deep packet inspection on the wire, generally, and actually detecting that it's Tor. They have no state. For example, they see the IP address and the port number, and they know it's a Tor server because it's in the Tor directory. So this is basically how Alice would use it, right? Alice can't go directly to the relay. Obviously can't go to censored Bob over there in the corner. But instead, blocked Alice can talk to Bob the Bridge, if we will. And now Alice has a way into the Tor network. And there are some serious problems with this approach. One of them is that bridge discovery is pretty obvious, right? If you are a Tor relay, you can see some bridges, probably. That's bad news. We have some ideas for how to fix that. But so far, we found that the Chinese government, for example, really was pissed off about Tor or something. But around the 60th anniversary of their country, they decided that they were going to block Tor. So we had about 10,000 servers, or 10,000 users at the server, and it just dropped right off almost to zero. A little small hiccup when their filter must have had some issues. But this is a server I run in Holland, and this server regularly handles well over 10,000 connections a second, really. It's just like crazy amounts of traffic. And this is just Chinese users. And they did successfully block those users. But the interesting thing is, because we had been thinking about bridges for many years, this is what happened next. Right? Isn't that a nice graph? So we can look at that. This is graphing censorship right here, right? Blocked? Response. What do you suppose the people want? So I think that's pretty fantastic, but it doesn't actually solve the social problem, right? Which is that they still have these filters, and you know, Cisco built them and deployed them, and I suppose other companies did too, but definitely Cisco. Those total motherfuckers even put in their sales presentation that they could help oppress minorities, such as the Falun Gong. That's pretty impressive. Like, when your salespeople actually do that, I mean, that's like real cold-hearted sons of bitch attitude, like just unbelievable. Like, I hope that they enjoyed the millions of dollars they made on that, because they lost all credibility when doing that. And they discredited all their brilliant engineers who don't feel that way. It's real bad news. And they have done nothing to atone for that, which is pretty bad. So these blocking events actually happen on a pretty regular basis. So at the moment, one of the things that we're seeing is that about every quarter, they've actually harvested bridges. So I mentioned you can get this from a website. And they actually harvest these bridges by visiting the website from all over the different world, using different proxies to connect up. And then they block them. And they block them as they find them. So there's a nice little graph here that shows this. So this is our bridge use. And you remember I showed you earlier, that's where the graph went down. And we saw bridge use spike. And so the Chinese, they took a while to catch on. But you can note that at different periods, such as just at the beginning of March, there was a huge bunch of those bridges that were taken out. So we still see approximately the same amount of users as we would expect to see. But we see that in some cases, we lose 20,000 users in a day, just overnight like that. And this is a statistical sampling, and it's an anonymized sample. So the issue here, of course, is that it's not totally accurate. It's still difficult to count anonymized users, because we don't have a login and password database, for example. There's nothing like that. So this sample is just a small representation of what's actually happening. And I think that's a pretty good resistance, but it's obviously not doing so great as of today, right? And the reason is because the Chinese have discovered enough bridges that they were able to block enough of the users that we've got nothing on that. And this is still better than the previously intractable problem of simply blocking everything all the time. So bridges are still useful. And we have two different types of bridges. We have private bridges that you can give to your friends that are traveling to China, and the only way they'll get blocked is if they tell someone about them. And public bridges, which are the ones that we hand out in a sort of strange and organized but very segmented fashion. So I wanted to take you through a miniature tour of the Middle East. So this is Lebanon. You'll note that content filter denied message is an old exploitable version of SQUID. So this is the Ojero proxies. Take a look at those IP addresses. Those are old, as I mentioned, exploitable SQUID boxes. All the traffic from that country on Ojero goes through those IP addresses. Yeah, everybody have those? OK, cool. Well, the slides will be on later, so you can just grab them. It's pretty awesome. When you're in Beirut, you'll have the opportunity to see these yourself. You'll note that it's not DNS censorship, so they're not actually blocking DNS. So you can get the normal IP address. It doesn't matter. Tor would give you DNS in this case anyway. But you can find this with just a simple tool like TCP traceroute. This host is actually in Austria. It's definitely not four hops away. I mean, Lebanon has a relatively good internet connection as far as the Middle East is concerned, but it's not that good. And 209 milliseconds is maybe reasonable in certain circumstances. But latency can pretty much always go up. It can never really go down. So in this particular case, we can be pretty sure that that's not actually directly making a TCP connection to that server, but it's being proxied. And of course, we find that if we try just on port 443, that it in fact goes through that fourth hop. And we also note that it adds about, 2,000 more milliseconds of latency. And eventually, it does get there. But it doesn't at the moment tamper with SSL traffic. I'm just guessing that the machine itself can't handle it. The load for that cluster is just beyond what is reasonable. And to still be able to pass traffic, it has to sort of shunt other traffic away that would take a lot of CPU time. And I imagine it would get a lot of errors. We saw this in Burma recently, where the Burmese government actually started using what we think is a blue coat device, but we're not totally certain. But it appears to be a blue coat device that was man-in-the-middling all SSL traffic for the entire country. Right? But they didn't have a CA. But that's the only reason that people found it, is they tried to log into their Gmail and they got man-in-the-middled. I mean, that's not too surprising. It's only surprising that it's possibly happening on a countrywide level. I mean, it's a small country, but it's still, that's a big deal. And I actually had the misfortune of meeting a guy that worked at Blue Coat at a party a couple of years ago. And he said, yeah, well, you know, moral access, whatever. I don't have a problem with that. We make money. That's what's important. Yeah, I don't think so, you know. First against the wall, right? So it's pretty bad. It's pretty bad news, I think, that this filter exists. And so you can take a look at that, and you can actually see how it exists. Some really awesome guys from Phenolit released a bunch of old exploits, old now, but they were new at the time, for SQUID, and all of them worked against these machines, I hear. And that is something that is just over the top ridiculous. Like, can you imagine that? You deploy a countrywide filter with free software, and you can't even patch it. That is really sad. So Lebanon has another ISP, which has to be the most unfortunately named ISP ever for a country with a reputation of Hezbollah and Hamas. But Terranet totally makes sense. I mean, they're trying to say Earthnet, right, or Earthlink, or you know, something like that. But anyway, totally bad. That's a horrible name for that ISP. But they are, in fact, terrorizing, sorry for the bad pun, their citizens on the internet. So for example, that proxy that I list up there, go ahead and take a look at that as well. Got it? Type it out. You've got a laptop. Go ahead, write it down. But as you can tell, obviously, the IP address that I have for my computer in this cafe is totally different than what I show up to for certain traffic. So it goes through that filter. It's like every time you buy something online, every time you have a conversation with someone, depending on where the traffic is going in terms of port number and protocol, you end up going through this box, which is owned by God knows how many people. I mean, it's just unsafe computing at its finest. So you can again find this. This time, it was only two hops away. I was really impressed by the cross-connect that they have in that cafe in Beirut. I mean, it's extremely close. So, but of course, it's not really that. So, and Qatar is a little more transparent with their filtering in that it's obvious that they're filtering. Ironically, the Lebanese are doing pretty reasonable but crappy transparent filtering. But in Qatar, they're just straight up with you. They want you to know how they feel about what you're trying to do, right? I mean, it's pretty clear that this is the issue. And it's also pretty clear that if you think something's wrong, you can email their help address there. And they tell you happily. And you'll note Tor is disabled, which is why that filter works. So it looks like they're using this software called NetSweeper, which is produced in Canada. I have the CEO's phone number on the next slide. But here, what you see is this entire like set of parameters. And it's fantastic. You can see the filter and the username. And it tells you a net block and the IP address of the user. So let's say you want to frame somebody in Qatar for going to a certain website. Just change that. Just pick a different IP address and pick a different site that you're trying to go to, and you will enter a log entry that puts that person potentially in some trouble. Good times. So, here are the IP addresses of those proxies, if you'd like to take a look at them. NetSweeper is probably a buggy piece of crap like every other piece of software ever written. So, that's a thought. And of course, these are their executive officers, if you'd like to call them. And their website's right there. I'm pretty sure it's their software. It seems to look like it. And they should be ashamed of themselves for selling this type of technology to an entire country, especially where there's a state telecom monopoly. I mean, I think that this very clearly violates what the United Nations considers to be a fundamental right to access of information. And I think that this is a bad precedent to set. So I think we shouldn't just stand by and let that happen. So I admit that I have an interest in Iran. And I've been looking a little intensely at the Iranian internet for some time. And I think that it's of interest if only because you can actually see them re-architect their internet almost in real time during some unpleasantness that has arrived in their country. And so I did some scans, and they actually called the ISP and had my machine pulled off the internet, which I was like, you know, you could have just asked me nicely, and I would have stopped. So in response, I put up 5 more machines and resumed scanning, and that was much better. I got the information that I wanted, and it was kind of interesting. So a note on the filtering in Iran. It's essentially the same as other places, but it's a little more insidious. I gave you that quote from the Iranian police chief earlier, and that guy is doing his job, which is an unfortunate thing for the people of Iran. But essentially what happens is that they have a lot of internet traffic. I mean, it's still small by comparison to basically every country that's actually really wired. But they have enough internet traffic. And they sort of have a knob. And what they do is they say, like, you know, the internet right now, it's not working out for us. So they just kind of slow it down. And they just sort of bring things to a trickle. And that is, of course, a really, really serious problem. But it's nice because it means that the internet still kind of works. They do block a lot of things. Like, for example, they do block Facebook, and they block it by IP address and name. But it means that they have recently taken an interest in this, because you can actually see there was a time very recently in the last 10 months where it wasn't possible for them to turn that knob. So they actually pulled the internet connections at the border and started pushing new boxes in. Arbor Networks wrote a paper about this, where you could see them adding 1 gigabit of filtered capacity at a time. So that's kind of an interesting thing. And you know, the reason that's possible is because of companies like Nokia, right? And the fact of the matter is that this nice girl, Netta, who was shot in the heart while walking past a demonstration with her father, it's this kind of shit that shouldn't be allowed to happen. And the reason that it's happening is because of technology like this, right? Because what's possible is it's possible to dispatch people in extreme quickness to a situation where there's some kind of peaceful demonstration, and then they use extreme force. And maybe they turn off cell phone networks in that area, or maybe they wiretap all the people that are in that area. And that's something that I also think, obviously, shouldn't happen. So Nokia actually sold equipment to the Iranian government, and they said, and this is fantastic, that it's our fault. Every country in the so-called West that has asked for wireless or wired wiretapping of some sort of intercept capability, they have the exact same capability as the Iranians. So what are we complaining about? And I think they're right. We shouldn't do that either. I think the trade-off we're making is a trickle-down, which is that we are trading some of our civil liberties for all of someone else's civil liberties. And I think that that is a really bad choice. So I'd like to celebrate by giving you the IP address of the Iranian Telecommunications Research Center, 80191.2.0/24, which has these fantastic hosts, such as SMS monitoring, .itrc.ac.ir, mediaproxy.itrc.ac.ir. And I think it's kind of interesting. You should take a look at that. If you'd like to know about the people that shot that girl in the heart, the mail server for the police force, the Besiege, is that webmail.besiege.ir. Right? Take action. Do something about it if you're really unhappy about it. I mean, send them an email. I'm sure they'd like to hear from you. And Andy Mueller from the CCC gave me this slide. And I feel like this is a fantastic slide. Not because of the guy being beaten, but because of the women that are coming to his aid. Right? This slide represents what's actually happening, which is that regular people are rising up and are resisting in these situations because it's just gone too far. And Iran is just like a popular example. It's happening all over the place. And when you see this type of thing, you have to stop it. I mean, it's easier said than done, I suppose. But a kind of funny little bug that I want to mention, which is that if you tried to get a URL in Iran, but you used a space between each of the letters, one of them would be filtered and the other one would not. And some group called Green Anti-Sec released a tool that would actually just split the requests and send them out. And everybody knows about it, so it's not really too much of a secret, but it should give you an idea about the level of quality assurance done on these filters, right? That is pretty low. So unfortunately, as I mentioned before, this technical stuff is easy to circumvent. I mean, we see the level of proxies we're talking about, and it's not really that big of a deal, right? Most of these are trivial for even a partially technical person to circumvent. But socially, it gets 90% or 100% sometimes of the people. Just everybody just has no idea. They've never heard about circumvention. They've never heard about anonymity. Or they've heard about a filter, but they don't actually have an idea about what they want out of a circumvention project. So maybe they don't use something that is good, or maybe they use something that is good. But for example, there was an American who was urging people to set up squid proxies with no crypto. And that was, I mean, that's just crazy foolishness. And that's something that I think we have to be wary of, right? You have to, when you see snake oil crypto out there, you've got to break it, and you have to embarrass the people that put that software out there, because often people's lives are at risk, and the people don't even know that their lives are at risk, and the people writing that software have the best of intentions, but they are still going to get people put in jail or killed or worse. So I want to show you a real quick example about Burma. So Burma was being filtered by Fortinet for a while, and that's basically a piece of software called FortiGuard, and they said that they weren't involved in Burma. So this is actually one of their main salespeople handing a Fortinet device to the military junta in Burma. So they stopped saying that they weren't involved because they had kind of been caught on state television. But what you'll note now is that there's only about 200 machines in Burma that allow you to connect to them over the internet. And almost all of those machines are Cisco routers. So congratulations, we won. What did we win? I guess a pony for, I'm not even sure what, honestly. But basically what we ended up with was some social change that really didn't change a lot, right? So unfortunately, it seems to be the case that even when we do make some kinds of changes, the social change that needs to take place hasn't. And in places like Burma, the only way that's going to happen is when the people of Burma and the people outside of Burma say enough is enough. And that's, I think, not necessarily an easy thing to do, but I think we can work on that, and we can work on that together. So instead of being upset by these things and going home and doing nothing, there's a really simple thing that you can do, which is that you can check this box. You can install Tor, and you can say that you would like to help censored users. And when you do that, you will directly evict one of those 20,000 people that currently can't get past the Great Firewall in China, or you will help someone else that's in another place, maybe even Poland, in a place that's extremely filtered. So the last thing is that Julian Assange from WikiLeaks wanted me to send you a nice little message, which is that he believes that the people of Poland are still radical enough that they can help make a difference. That most of the people, I mean, to paraphrase him here, but most of the people here have a long enough memory to remember when this kind of thing was happening in a different situation, but it's essentially still the same power grab. And so he encourages you, and I encourage you by proxy, to consider if you have any documents that are interesting to submit them to WikiLeaks. And potentially you can help by stopping a war before it even starts, or by telling truth that someone else is afraid to say. And I encourage you I encourage your use of Tor, and I also encourage your use of WikiLeaks together, because I think they can be fantastic, and hopefully it can protect you. And hopefully you can help to protect the world that we live in together with those tools. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Applebaum, for your lecture. And now I want to invite you for the 5-minute break. And after the break, please sit on the seats, because girls have to have an easy access to these higher seats. Because if you want to ask any questions, you have to wait for the microphone, because everything is being recorded. And we just. So please, take seats here, okay? For those who are sitting on the stairs. Okay, so let's have a break.